Sorry, seven. Let me start over again. Can you erase that? The great 6th century prophet who is prophesying in Jerusalem, and he's trying to scare his people into understanding that when you don't care about the poor or the rights of the poor, when you worship gods, not the living God, but Molechs, where you sacrifice your daughters, literally, on an altar, when you skew weights and measures, when you tell your people that everything is okay, when government and religion are combined, king and priestly aristocracy, in a way which is unhelpful, then you need a Jeremiah to come into the picture and stand up and prophesy, even though Jeremiah didn't want to do this because his family plotted against him. He was thrown into prison. They tried to poison him, and everyone, to a man or woman, hated him. And nevertheless, he had to speak a notion of judgment, because in 587, 586 BC, the Babylonian army under Nebuchadnezzar would surround the city of Jerusalem because of its sin and destroy it completely, and then send the exiles hundreds of miles east into Babylon. So Jeremiah is writing right before catastrophe happens. And God is speaking through him about the need to reform and change before it's too late. Hear God's word to us. The people of Israel and Judah have done nothing but evil in my sight from their youth, says God. Indeed, the people of Israel have done nothing but provoke me with what their hands have made idols, declare the Lord. From the day it was built until now, the city has so aroused my anger and wrath that I must remove it from my sight. The people of Israel and Judah have provoked me by all the evil they have done. They, their kings and officials, their priests and prophets, the men of Judah and the people of Jerusalem, they turn their backs to me and not their faces. Though I taught them again and again, they would not listen or respond to discipline. They set up their abominable idols in the house that bears my name and defiled it. They built high places for Baal, the fertility god, in the valley of Ben-Hinnom. Just a side note, they sacrificed their children in the valley of Ben-Hinnom, in the valley of Hinnom. And that's where we get our word for hell, because hell really means in the Greek Gehenna, and that is the valley of Hinnom, which became a trash dump because sacrifices were offered to idol. So, to Molech, though I never commanded, nor did it enter my mind, the Lord said, that they should do and seek such a detestable thing, and so make Judah a sin. My second reading from Jeremiah is the one that you have in your bulletin. And that is that God gives his people hope. He says, after the destruction of Jerusalem and you're carried away, nevertheless, in spite of that, I will come to you and I will rescue you and I will make you a new people, and I will put in you not a heart of stone, but a beating heart filled with life. And this is the promise that happens through the smog and haze of the nearing destruction of Jerusalem. God says, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will fulfill the gracious promise I made to the house of Israel and to the house of Judah. In those days, at that time, I will make a righteous branch sprout from David's line. And this one, Jesus, I think, will do what is just and right in the land. In those days, Judah will be saved, and Jerusalem will live in safety. That is the name by which it will be called, the Lord our righteousness. Our New Testament reading comes to us from the Gospel of Luke, the 21st chapter, beginning to read at the 25th and reading through to the 28th verse. This and its parallels in Mark and Matthew are perhaps one of the most difficult passages in Scripture that we have, because Jesus is talking about the end of the world. Jesus is talking about the end of the world and how the whole cosmology, suns and stars, will be darkened, and we will see signs on the earth and above the earth, which signals an end. But it's confusing because Jesus is also talking about the destruction of Jerusalem a second time, which occurs in AD 70 under Titus, where Jerusalem again is razed to the ground. And what Jesus seems to be saying is, that's not the end. Even though you'll see portents and things, that AD 70 in August, when Jerusalem is razed, is not the end. But rather the end will come in crazy and disastrous ways. But Jesus affirms, nevertheless, no matter what happens, that Jesus will be with us. And through the catastrophe, we will more than survive, but we will survive. So this is a portion of what is called the little apocalypse. There will be signs in the sun, moon, and stars. On the earth, nations will be in anguish and perplexity at the roaring and tossing of the sea. Men will faint from terror, apprehensive of what is coming in the world, for the heavenly bodies will be shaken. And at that time, they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. When these things begin to take place, stand up and lift up your heads, because your redemption is drawing near. This is the word of the Lord. When our world falls apart, when our world becomes unglued, you know, the falling of the stars and the roaring of the seas are wonderful metaphors of that. But when we look at a macrocosmic level, we realize this is also important too, because as we approach December 21st, we're approaching the end of the world, right, with the Mayan calendar. The Mayans have told us that the world is going to come to an end. And I think some archaeologists are trying to modify that in a way of saying the world will turn in a different direction. But we in America take that and say, no, the world's coming to an end and all these things are going to happen and it's not going to be good. Just like Y2K, remember that? The world was coming to an end in 2000. You don't know about a William Miller, but he was a Christian who lived between Whitehall and that great ski area in Killington. And you go on, I think it's Route, I don't know what the route is, 9, I think. And there's a little church there, and there's an Ascension Rock in back of the church. In the mid-19th century, William Miller, the good Christian, said the world is coming to an end in 1843. So everyone donned white robes, they sold their farms and everything else, and they just kind of waited, and nothing happened. So instead of saying, I'm sorry, I made a mistake, he said, no, I think it's coming in 1844. So just be prepared. And the Jehovah's Witnesses have done that all along, right? And they've gotten it wrong every time. So now if you go to a kingdom hall or something, they're not talking as much about the end of the world and Armageddon, because they realize, man, their track record isn't very good when it comes to prognostication and predictability. So I think when we look at texts like this, which talk about the cosmos, we have to say that God is in control. And in fact, God has always been in control. And if we posit a creation which goes back 38 billion years, and we posit a world in which God had dominion over the plants and animals and took care of everything, you know, we are new on the planet. If we talk about early hominids who kind of come into being around 200,000 years ago, BC, we talk about kind of what we see humanity becoming. And humanity was inherently religious from the beginning. And don't let anyone tell you otherwise. From 45,000 to 35,000 BC, we see these wonderful cave paintings. And they betoken an idea that there is a spirituality that is out there and special. And they affirm what the Apostle Paul says in Romans 1, that, you know, all of us have some understanding of God when we look at the reality of nature and the beauty and wonder of our world. So I believe when we look at this apocalypse here, we can say no matter what happens on the grand scale of things, that God is in control and there is an order to reality, so that when we feel disordered, when we feel as if our worlds are falling apart, when we feel as if we are coming unglued, we just need to look at the stars as Abraham did and say, I know you love me and there is order and all is well. However, that's not what I'm preaching on this morning. And you're saying to yourself, oh my goodness, we have communion too and the guy's going to stay more. Oh Lord, help me. Lord, help the time to go quickly. Oh Lord. Well, I want to talk about the idea of anxiety because that is inherent in both texts. And in many ways, when you look at Jeremiah, you understand that before the catastrophe of Nebuchadnezzar, that Jeremiah is trying to say to his people, I'm going to scare the wits out of you so you'll change your ways before Babylon is onset and takes hold of you. I want you to change, so I'm going to scare you into change. Now, I know from a scientific perspective, when we look at TV and we see all those terrible ads about what happens when people smoke and what their lungs look like, they're awful ads, aren't they? Are you aware of what I'm talking about? Well, scientists tell us that those ads really don't work. That often when we try to scare people, that doesn't work. And I know as a substance abuse clinician back in New York City, that often scare tactics didn't work as well. You know, I had people who were on marijuana. They were my age, you know. They were walking around in the times of Noah. They were stoners from way back, you know, with marijuana. And they would say, you know, they remember this movie in the mid-50s called Reefer Madness, where just one toke of marijuana would make you crazy and do all sorts of crazy things. And they would laugh at that. They were more interested in understanding the real issues of marijuana, which was that it destroys initiative, it's more dangerous to the lungs than even cigarette smoking, and that stoners can be very angry people as well, which we forget. So the idea of anxiety is a good thing is what I'm dealing with, what Jeremiah deals with, and in many ways what Jesus deals with. In positing the issue of the stars kind of falling and the seas roaring, Jesus is saying, you know, the way you live your lives in the present tense is important. And if there is something that scares you, maybe that's God intended so that you'll change your ways. You must change your life, Rilke says in that wonderful poem. You must change your life. And if it's anxiety which is the impetus, I think that's good. I think that's good. And I think when I look at a global level, you know, as we went down, and we hope to go back on December 15th and work down in a sandy-ravaged area. But it's interesting when you look at Katrina, when you look at Irene, when you look at Sandy. You wonder sometimes, you know, we kind of dismiss the idea of global warming. We say it's not really an issue. It's not really an issue at all. But in the light of what's happened, you know, maybe in Spiro Agnew's term, maybe the nattering nabobs of negativism are beginning to recede when we begin to rethink that issue of global warming, and it indeed may be an issue. And I'm not here to scare you. I'm a historian, and one of my interests, as you know, is in the 13th century. And from the 13th century to the 18th century, we have been in a little ice age. It began at the beginning of the 13th century. The 12th century was a very, very positive era. Technological innovation was wedded with science. A lot of monastic movements began to grow. It was a wonderful time, but in the 13th century, things go south. And with the onset of the Little Ice Age, their arable lands shrink. The Baltic Sea freezes. And there is mass starvation in the city. So much so that chroniclers back then talk about poor people eating acorns, and if they're not eating acorns, they're eating themselves. So I'm not trying to scare you right now. because I understand that there is geological change, great geological change throughout our history. I'm not trying to scare you now, but boy, when I'm down there in Brooklyn, it gives me pause. And I wonder whether we need to do something about that. And I wonder whether in that light, anxiety is good because it moves us to action on a national or perhaps a global level. Anxiety is the impetus and go that we need. And what about our smaller groups? What about this church? We have in our budget, and I'm not preaching a stewardship sermon because the consistory in their enlightened ways said, we don't want you to preach stewardship sermons. You can't balance your checkbook. We don't want you to be involved in any sort of financial dealings in our church. What we want you to do is maybe what you do the best, and that's teaching. So get out into the community and just teach. And I am grateful for that. I truly am. But I have to be concerned with money, and we're upfront and honest about it. We have less than $400,000 in the bank. And we have to take out money every year to pay our classes dues, the dues we owe to the denomination, and oh yes, to pay me. So this may be a self-serving sermon, but I don't want it to be. I want it to be about this wonderful, beautiful church which was founded in 1801. And I want to scare us, because if we keep taking money out, we will reach a point, and how is this as an image? That there will be a lift that goes up and will take down the cross. How is this as an image that we're just going to remove all the pews here? And what we're going to do is we're going to sell it as private property, and it's going to be a boutique. Or it's going to be an art gallery. Or it's going to be a restaurant. Or like the church up in Catskill, it's going to be a gym. Main Street in Catskill, a church is a gym now. Thanks be to God. You know, so I'm not trying to scare us, but I'm trying to say I need us all to have an image of what this sacred space might be if we are not diligent and constant. And may anxiety goad us to do what God calls us to do for this faith community in every way. It's awful when I go into a place where the cross is taken down. I used to teach at Unification Seminary, not that I'm a Mooney, but they wanted Reformed theology taught once a semester, and I was happy to do that. But it used to be owned by a monastic group, I guess, and you go into the sanctuary and there's no cross. And that was very sad. And what can we do, I wonder, in terms of fear in our society? I mean, we're entering a season in which the average gift that we give someone costs $950. That's the average gift. We spend, in spite of depression or recession, $150 billion a year on gift giving. Can I say that figure again? $150 billion a year. I'm wondering whether that money could be spent in better ways. But I also wonder whether God will give us a dream or a vision. And I can see what that vision is on January, where it's in bold letters in the cloud saying, "This is your credit card statement." Can we imagine what it's like for God to say, look, I'm going to scare you right now so much in December 2nd that you're going to pull back and not do what you've done in the past. You're going to economize a little bit because the people you love don't need all that. And you don't need to max out your credit card. I mean, is God scaring us in that way? Or is God scaring us in another way? We're deciding that this Christmas is going to be, we're going to do more. We're going to decorate our house so that Martha Stewart will be envious. We're going to run here and there and do this and that and everything. We're going to do it all. And that'll be good. And then God gives us a vision of us coming to a psychiatrist in January and saying, hey, can you up my antidepressant a bit? I think I need to be on anti-anxiety meds because, you see, I overdid it. And if we recognize that now, if the fear of the Lord is in us, then we're not going to do stupid things. And often we do stupid things during the holiday season. And there are things maybe not that are stupid, but they're not fully congruent with who we are as Christians. And I think that's important. And also, you know, on a personal level, does God discombobulate us? Does God give us a vision of falling stars and roaring seas to remind us and to scare us into right living? God may want to scare us into right living. And it may not be that we're living wrong necessarily. It's just that we're not living intentionally and thoughtfully. This past Thursday, I decided, as I've done, to ride my mountain bike. And because Hurley Mountain Road is closed here, I've been riding on Lucas Turnpike. So what I do is ride my mountain bike up to Lucas Turnpike, then I make a left by the bridge at High Falls, and then I ride down to Rosendale. And if I'm very ambitious, then I'll ride out to Springtown Road and go to New Paltz, and then ride back and then take a break and go to Binnewater, the Binnewater Way, and come back. Well, I was riding my road bike on this Thursday, and I got clipped by a car. About 100 yards from Leggett Road, and, you know, auditorily, it was crash, bang. And I'm kind of just standing there, and I just kind of fall off. There was no shoulder, but it was like falling off in hay, you know? I mean, it was the grass had not been mowed in a year or two. So it was like falling onto a mattress. The woman named Olga, who I think was fairly new to our country, had just gotten her citizenship, I think, not long ago, stopped 200 yards away, and, you know, she's throwing up her hands and saying, should we call the ambulance? Should we call 911? What should we do? And I said, well, let me just check. You know, I'm not feeling as bad as I should be with that sound, that crashing sound in my head. So I take off a few layers of fleece that I have on, and I'm okay. I'm not bleeding, and I'm a bleeder, and I can't find a bruise, and my elbow is sore. You know that? But she said, what should I do? I said, just take me back home. Take me back to the church. So she did this. So I pulled my bike out of her hatchback, and I said to Joyce Pinkney, I said, Joyce, I've been hit by this woman over there. That wasn't very Christian. That woman hit me over there. And poor Olga's going, you know. And Joyce said, well, why are you riding your bike? You know, aren't you more concerned with your body than your bike? I said, no, I'm much more concerned with my bike than my body. So she said, are you all right? I said, I think so. So Joyce had a crocheting group in there, you know, and so Doris Alden, our wonderful EMT, came out and she said, okay, do this with your arm. Yeah, it's okay. I don't think anything's broken. It's going to be a little swollen. And then she said, you know, lift it up, put a lot of ice on it, which I did. She said, take Advil. You're going to need a lot of Advil because you're really going to be sore. So I put ice on it, and instead of the Advil, I had two glasses of Riesling wine instead. I thought that might be better than the Advil, and indeed it was. But I woke up the next day, and I had no pain. I had no swelling. That evening, I had to give a talk at the Fair Street Reformed Church on a book that they had read and I had read, and they wanted my input on it along with a rabbi, and I felt fine. The next day, I felt fine. In fact, I joked with a friend on Friday evening. I said, it was almost as if I had an unintended chiropractic adjustment on Lucas Avenue because I've had tendonitis in this left arm, and it feels much better than it did before the accident. I am fine. And you know what my fear is? That I'm too fine. And that somehow it's going to be easy for me to say to the Lord, look, I can go out on Lucas Avenue again. This was just a fluke. This woman had sun in her eyes. I can do that again. And God says, buddy, you better not. Buddy, you better not. This was a warning. I want you to be afraid. I want you to have some common sense, which at times is lacking in your life. And just not do. So God scares us so that we don't indulge in self-harm, whether we intentionally do it or unintentionally do it. And I think that is very important. And how do we help other people? I think other people need us as a Jeremiah. When I go into the hospital, you know, I'm more bold now than I used to be. I'm more bold when I go into the hospital than I used to be. And there are some illnesses which we don't cause. It just happens upon us. But there are some illnesses which we may cause. And I have to go into the hospital and I say, look, I think you're going to be better off if you stop smoking. I think you're going to be better off if you stop drinking and drugging. I think you're going to be better off if you lose some weight. I think you're going to be better off if you are religious and taking your medication. And people say, okay, I get it. And I'll say, because I don't want you to continue in the way you're going. I don't want that at all, and Jesus doesn't want that, and God doesn't want that. So you need to be responsible for yourselves. Paul says in Philippians, work out your salvation with fear and trepidation. Yes, yes, fear. I close, and I'm still feeling the impact of this bicycle accident, because again I'm a little discombobulated with a sermon. But I want to close with one of my favorite philosophers, Søren Kierkegaard, who wrote in the 19th century, and he says anxiety is an adventure. Anxiety is an adventure which every human being must go through. To learn to be anxious in order that we might not perish, either by never having been in anxiety or by succumbing to anxiety, whoever has learned to be anxious in the right way has learned the ultimate. May we learn anxiety in the right way so that we are protected and safe and doing what the Lord would have us do. Thanks be to God. Amen. Please stand and greet one another.